traveled from a remote place in Tibet to India three times in his life to bring the teachings from India back to Tibet, and there to transmit the teachings of the Buddha Dharma for the benefit of all beings. And the first time he went, he was fairly young. It was a difficult trip there. There were many bandits. Tibet, even today, is kind of like the Old West in the United States. Bandits everywhere, and people running around with swords, stealing from travelers, and fairly ruthless condition. A lot of wild animals everywhere in Tibet, wild animals, bears and wolves, jaguars, snow lions, and then of course the infamous Garuda, the big bird that's not born from an egg. So he traveled walking, took about 6 months of walking to get to India, and studied with Naropa. And Naropa is the, of course, you know all about Naropa. Here you are at Naropa. And he brought the many, many teachings of the Vajrayana teachings back to Tibet. And as he was traveling over a lake on his way back to Tibet, I don't remember the detail, but somebody in the boat with him tried to take the teachings, the scriptures from him, and they were, the boat flipped over, and all the teachings were lost in the water. And so he went home without anything to bring back, and went a second time, and this time when he came back he had many things to translate and became known as Marpa the translator. The last time he went to India, he was 82 years old, which was really an unimaginable kind of a trip. And Naropa was dead when he arrived. So it's said that he studied with the Dakinis in a different, his teachings came from a different dimension at that point. And he brought back the full-blown Vajrayana teachings and became the head of the beginning of the what's called the Kagyupa lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, sometimes known as the Red Hat sect. And he had a son and a wife. His wife, Damema, was equally accomplished to Marpa. Marpa was very well known as an agricultural reformer. He was a very important person in his community. He cared very much about everyone in his village. And the farming practices, he said to have invented a radical type of agriculture called weeding. Before that time, they didn't know that you could pick bad plants from more productive plants to give you more wheat or more barley than you would otherwise get just by picking the barley from everything that's growing. So he introduced the practice of weeding to Tibet. He had a son who he thought would become the heir of his lineage. But his son, when he was about 20, 21 years old, was killed in a horseback riding accident. There's a kind of a story about that, they say, of he was crying and crying and crying for days on end. And other students would came to him and say, "Marpa, you're such an accomplished master who knows the source of all suffering. Why do you cry when your son is gone? He's just an ephemeral existence. Marpa said, well, I lost my son, and started crying. So the who was to succeed this teaching was doubtful. And then this crazy hermit poet named Milarepa arrived one day to study with Marpa. And that's a whole long, different kind of a story of their relationship. You've probably read about Milarepa. Milarepa was had accumulated some very bad karma by doing black magic. He was a very powerful poet and magician that knew how to turn natural forces to evil ways. And he had practiced black magic in the past and it caused harm to come to others. So he had a lot of a story that had to be cleared up, and Marpa would have him build a house out of rocks, and then once it was finished, he'd have him take apart the house and build another house. And this went on and on and on and on. And Milarepa's story always was, he'd go to Damema at night after Marpa had gone to sleep and say, oh, please intercede with Marpa. So he teaches everybody else, but he doesn't teach me anything. He just has me build these houses and take them apart. Damema said, oh, yes, Marpa is a terrible guy. He's so mean to you. I'll try to talk to him over breakfast and see if I can do something for you. And still, Marpa was relentless with Milarepa. And then eventually it became clear Milarepa was the true transmissionaire of Marpa and became the next in that lineage. So that in brief is the story of Marpa. And this character is very important to me personally. I named my garden business after Marpa. When I first moved to Boulder, when Naropa first began, I started a company called Marpa Mowers, and we used to mow lawns. And then we became Marpa Landscaping, and now we have a big kind of like Marpa's own history, and grew organically into something else that looks quite different right now than what it did. But Marpa has always been, I have a statue of Marpa just as you enter the house in this niche with the light over him. He's kind of a butch character. He's got kind of a flat top. He's hefty, you know, like Milarepa has long earlobes and is real sensual. But Marpa's kind of tough guy. I don't know that a day's gone by that I haven't thought in some way about Marpa for many years now. Any questions? About anything?
So,
in the
life of Marpa,
it reminds me of a friend of mine was studying in Japan in a monastery and wrote me once after he'd been there for many years that it seems what happens is somebody gets something really going on in life that everybody recognizes, and then when that person dies they say, oh, we've got to formalize this, and so we'll build walls that will capture what this is all about. We'll train people so that they'll be able to duplicate what that person had. But he said he wondered after all the, he spent so many years there in monastery, whether it's ever getting back to that original inspiration that Marpa had once you start all that. I'm sure it all makes sense, but somehow in our world here of lay practice and kind of taming the mind out of nowhere. Marpa is quite an inspiring character that doesn't rely on anything at all, any institutions. The institutions came long after Marpa. And yet he's probably the most realized of all the, if there's a qualitative kind of condition, certainly Marpa is an inspired existence in the Tibetan lineage. Yes. Oh, even today, Tibetans will go off and do 2, 3, 4, or 5 years of retreat. You see them usually carrying a leg of a yak and a big bag of barley. Milarepa did long retreats eating nothing but nettles. He ate so many nettles he turned completely green. A lot of it is contentment, the practice of contentment. Whatever is there, you eat. If it's not there, you appreciate whatever is there, and you go on.
And are there precepts as well?
Yes. Definition of monks, nuns, and lay women, bhikshuni. Those are celibate people. They don't have a family life. All of them received Buddha Bodhisattva's precepts. Which is consisted as 200, more than 200, and more than 300 for bhikshuni, women, and there are not so many precepts for layman, laywomen. Usually, 5 major precepts are given to layman, laywomen. Monks have so many precepts to observe, but basically 10 major precepts. Those precepts were all handed down throughout the Buddhist countries. Theravadin, even today, they observe very many precepts to live in the, maybe undisturbed from everyday life, but the precepts they observe. Your question is then what the distinction between priest, priestess, and monks and nuns. I don't know, I'm supposed to be understood about this, but monks and nuns are devoted to the way, Buddha's way, you know, Bodhisattva's way. I'm not too much interested in creating the family life, or even do not to involve in, do not have interest in teaching other people. Not necessarily live in a monastery or a nunnery, but kind of determined life offered to the absolute and comes back from absolute. So what the core interest is seek, way seeking, and fully manifest your life, not for yourself, for all. Priests are more, in a way, more closely related to the media, to become a person who become media to absolute and relative. When I think about the life of Christ, he was a monk, I think. His life was totally dedicated to the absolute. When he says about himself and Yahweh, there is no one between them. I mean, their relationship was a real father and son's relationship. I always think about how come it happened. Sometimes you hear he's the only son of the Yahweh. Which we understand today, that when you are in faith of God, this relationship comes. You don't have any other person to relate to God. You don't bring. Also recall the Martin Buber's understanding of the relationship between you and the Absolute appear as a ich and du. You don't say God, he. It is not such relationship. Always you face God directly as ich and du, I and you. And the action you take in this world are always like that. You are relating to the God, to whomever. That's how the situation is. Very much like relationship of so-called monks and nuns. Each of them related to their salvation or unity of you and Absolute. Priests essentially same, but his or priestess job is to become not necessarily shamanistic way of life, but you go between Absolute and relative and try to unite their relationship. I don't know how you interpret, how you describe definition. Very much like people who call not necessarily the person who keep the position of the church, but what do you say? In Japanese we say Shinpu, Holy Father. You say father to priest of the church. What do you address? You say father, no? When I look at also how Christ was relating with people, I see the very clear characteristic of priest, like a person who goes to the village of the abandoned village of the leprosy. He didn't feel any fear to go visit them. By one glance of Christ, I lay the liberated mind from her past. Such kind of connections you feel not only monk's spirit of following the truth, but relationship doesn't stay in such simple way. It goes toward all things. When he says to his apostrophe, immediate disciples traveling, and one cold day, the aged person was lying the sideway, and when they came to the house, he said, "You think you are all my disciples, but none of you even shed the little blanket to that man." That man was actually myself. He spoke of like the instant like that. So you can also see his feeling of everything as his own manifested body, which is exactly same as how Yahweh continuously manifests even this moment. I say the absolute so easily, but it is a big subject. Dharma Kaya, we say, instead of absolute being. Dharma Kaya, true body. And when we have a simultaneous unity, you call this kind of body your body as a rainbow body. Because of you as a person exist in the universe, that some light touches you and you become a rainbow person. Oh yes, he did a long retreat. It was good. It was a good time, wasn't it? Certainly it was a difficult time for you, but best time to retreat, soldier retreat. Have you done long retreat, could you raise your hand? Yeah, yeah. More than 1 week. Oh, good. Yeah, sometimes, most of the time you don't think about it, but when your energy go down, so much things to do, you get so discouraged about your reserve of energy and wisdom and spirit. Such time you have to remove yourself. Milarepa developed such a magical power. Tantric teaching contains so much of those. You know why he practiced that? It was a way to revenge his uncle and his family. Because uncle took big wealth of Milarepa's parents from him and treated him very badly. So he couldn't get over the deep suffering. And yet, after he completed his revenge with mystical power, still he couldn't satisfy with himself. That time he met with Malapada. Was lucky to have met without Marupa. This doesn't exist, you know. So I was waiting his voice to recover until today. Thank you. Thank you again.